Today on Maine Calling, alcohol consumption and health. When it comes to federal guidelines on what to eat and drink, words matter. The new guidelines issued by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services regarding alcohol consumption remove specific wording about recommended limits to how many drinks someone should have per day. The new wording states simply to consume less alcohol. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today we'll learn what medical experts say about the links between alcohol consumption and health. A growing body of research finds alcohol in any amount increases risk for a number of different kinds of cancer. Studies also find harms to cardiovascular health due to alcohol. What does the latest scientific evidence say about alcohol's impact on the body? And what do physicians make of a common argument that drinking alcohol is ingrained in our culture and has benefits in terms of social connection and well-being? Maine Calling is coming right up.
Support for Maine Calling comes from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine, now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And Highland Green, an active 55-plus lifestyle community with a 230-acre nature preserve, highlandgreenlifestyle.com. And Bangor Savings Bank, committed to helping Northern New England communities thrive. You matter more. Bangor.com.
This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today, we are sorting through myths and mixed messages over alcohol consumption and health. Some of the confusion comes from recently changed federal guidelines, and some comes from evolving understanding of the impacts that alcohol has on health and disease. Joining me today to talk about that is Dr. Tim Namey. He's a physician and alcohol epidemiologist, and he's director of the University of Victoria's Canadian Institute for Substance Use Research and professor in the Division of Medical Sciences. We invite you to join the conversation. What do you want to know about the health impacts of drinking alcohol? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or you can give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. And welcome, Dr. Namey. So good to have you on the show today. We did a show a couple weeks ago on Maine Calling about the changes to the federal dietary guidelines, and we were able to talk a lot about the new food pyramid and those changes, which are also confusing. But we didn't get to talk that much about the alcohol consumption guidelines. So I'm referring to RFK Jr.'s DHHS new guidelines, and they are vaguer on alcohol guidelines than they used to be. So tell us about that. Sum up what changed in those alcohol limits that are recommended.
Sure. Cindy, first of all, thank you for having me on. It's great. I'm out here in Victoria, British Columbia, but I'm from the Boston area. And it's great to be on in Maine. A lot of good friends in Maine. And I always think that, like, there are two kinds of people in the world, people that live in Maine and those that wish they did. So
That's nice, so true.
Nice to be there today. Anyways, so the dietary guidelines. Yeah, I was actually on the U.S. Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee for the previous version of those, and also was one of the authors of a scientific report that was commissioned by the government to inform these current ones, which was suppressed, and we can maybe get back to that later on. But essentially, the amount of information in the dietary guidelines about alcohol was greatly reduced. And basically, however, that really the one message, which is, you know, for better health, drink less, actually perfectly summarizes the state of the evidence for the past 30 to 40 years. So, I mean, basically, if you wanted to end the show early, you know, in terms of health, you know, which is what, that's the avenue that I sit in, what it boils down to is that in terms of health, less is better. And so in a funny way, that was captured in the updated guidance. And that's pretty much the main point that it wanted to make. You know, of course, it's my job to complain about things a little bit, right? So what was lost? Well, what was lost is any kind of quantitative sort of guidelines. And again, these are, of course, just health recommendations. It's not anyone from the government or scientists telling people to what to do, and it's just in the health lane. But the previous guidelines talked about for days when men or women consume alcohol, about recommended limiting consumption to two drinks in a day for men and one in a day for women. Those recommended limits were dropped. And there's nothing about health information for consumers that where there's like perhaps less knowledge, like the fact that alcohol is causes or can cause seven major types of cancer, which is not new information, but it's relatively not appreciated by the public. There used to be information on the special risks associated with drinking for underage youth, for example. That's all gone. So the guidelines, while the overall message is good, lack any kind of specificity and sort of risk sounding like, the alcohol company ads where they say at the end, drink responsibly, because it doesn't really mean anything. But so
Right.
I'll just sort of pause there.
Well, right. So the wording was just consume less alcohol. So if you're drinking six drinks a day, and five is less, right? And so that's drastically different than what the limits were or the recommended limits were before. But let's at least set the stage a little bit in terms of what are you seeing in terms of alcohol consumption in American society? Is there a certain percentage of people who drink at least some alcohol every day?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, most American adults consume alcohol. Total consumption sort of rose through COVID time, but has actually dropped back a little bit. When we think about alcohol consumption, we have to think about it in a couple of different dimensions. The one dimension is like, what is somebody's average consumption or their total consumption over any given point in, like over per week or per month or per year? Because if we want to think about alcohol as a potentially toxic substance or harmful substance, is what the dose makes the poison. So we have to know how much are people consuming, right? Then we need to know the pattern in which they're consuming it. So there are a lot of people we know, for example, who may, when you say, okay, this is how much they drink per week or per month, it may sound sort of what we would consider to be socially moderate amount, but like maybe they're drinking all of that in one or two evenings a week. Well, that's a pattern of consumption. If it's five or more drinks in men or four or more drinks in women, that's referred to as binge alcohol use or binge drinking. So that results in legal impairment and also has a variety of other health effects that sort of are in addition to those caused by one's total dose of alcohol, if that makes sense.
Sure.
So that's kind of how we think about it. What's interesting is that just to jump back to the guidelines, is that if the old guidelines basically sort of suggested up to two drinks a day for men, for men who are drinking actually 14 drinks a week, that actually results, even though that's considered socially moderate, about 1 in 25 men drinking at that level, or 4% of all men drinking at two drinks per week, right? At just two drinks, sorry, two drinks per day on average, excuse me. 1 in 25 of them, or 4% of them, will die prematurely from an alcohol-related cause. So in our report, we highlighted that, and the logical conclusion is that the old recommended limit for men was actually associated with substantially elevated risk of premature death.
So that means that I read this actually, that those recommendations of, no more than two drinks for men, one drink for women per day were even about to be lowered. You were part of that group, right? L recommending that to be just one drink for both men and women. But now that's out the window too with these new guidelines.
Well, the job of our advisory committee, scientific advisory committee, was called the Alcohol Intake and Health Report, and it's about to be published in a journal very soon. But is not we weren't actually charged with making recommendations, but more just to do a careful scientific review of the relationship between alcohol consumption. And again, most of the data is about average consumption and mortality or death. And the key finding from that was that yes, at 2 drinks a day for men, there's substantially elevated risk. Whereas the risk at about 1 drink per day for men and women, the increase in risk is minimal, negligible, we could say. So yes, I think the logical conclusion from our findings and from other studies would be that, again, for people who drink, that limiting it to about a drink a day would improve their health.
So, something you just talked about some of the alcohol-caused diseases. I think in very recent times, people think, "Oh, what's the harm to your health of alcohol?" Well, it's either alcoholism or liver disease or maybe driving while intoxicated. Like those are the things you think of when you think the harms of alcohol to your health. But as you mentioned, alcohol and cancer now is much more. There's a lot more conversation about that connection, that there are very strong research linking the two. So, can you
Yeah.
talk about that and what the latest research is finding?
Yes. And you make a great point, Cindy, excuse me, is that some conditions are very easily traceable to alcohol, right? Alcohol, so-called alcohol-associated alcoholic liver disease is 100% caused by alcohol. Alcohol use disorder, which is a mental health diagnosis, that's 100% caused by alcohol. But there are a lot of other chronic diseases for which alcohol is a contributor, right? So for example, if somebody passes away from breast cancer, we cannot say exactly whether that death was due to alcohol or not. But at the population level, we can say, based on how much people drink, that somewhere around 15% of all deaths from breast cancer are actually caused by alcohol. So it gets a little bit sciencey on you, but it is easier for people to recognize things that are more clearly tied to alcohol, like impaired driving, car crashes, or fetal alcohol syndrome or spectrum disorder. So this brings us back to a lot of the big ticket chronic diseases like heart disease and cancers, where alcohol is a contributing factor, much the way smoking can be a contributing factor. And I think there's less appreciation for those. In the US, as in Canada, generally less than half of people are aware that alcohol is a risk factor for many leading cancers, and those would be breast, colon and rectum, liver, intestine, mouth, voice box, esophagus, swallowing tube, so some of the big ones. And they're less aware, actually, that alcohol consumption above small amounts actually is a risk factor for coronary heart disease, for heart failure, for high blood pressure. Especially binge drinking and high blood pressure really go hand in hand, and for irregular heart rhythms like atrial fibrillation.
So the tricky thing with all of those is that, people hear that and they say, well, how much? How much do you have to drink for those to be a risk? And I know it's a spectrum,
Yeah.
right? It's like, well, the more, the higher the risk. But how do you try to quantify that or talk to patients about that?
Well, I think it's difficult to convey that amount of information, and that's why we're always torn in science, but in particularly in public health, about how we sort of convey meaningful information in a way that's digestible and in a way that's time efficient. The nice thing about the study that we just did for the US government is that we kind of it gets very confusing, right? People are hearing, well, a little bit of alcohol isn't bad for your heart, which is, possibly true, but any amount of alcohol can be bad for cancer, which is true. So these different things. Well, the nice thing is in our study, for example, we look at all the causes of death for the US population, and we look at alcohol's contribution to all deaths from alcohol-related conditions at each and every level of consumption. So we kind of average out, if you will, the effects across liver disease, heart disease, cancers, that sort of a thing. And that's where we derive our recommendation that the risks start to go up above a drink a day on average.
So there were reports when, so the Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, before he left, his last recommendation, he made a big splash. It did hit the news about the links between alcohol and cancer. And again, people I don't think had that much on their radar that there was this clear connection. And then, and as you say, you know, there was sort of this effort to lower those recommended limits. I've read reports that a lot of the reason that it sort of got swept under the rug a bit, or not that the recommendations to lower those limits got squelched, I guess, were pressures from the alcohol industry. Is that something that does happen in this kind of situation?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on it, but I know for the committee of scientists that worked on the alcohol intake and health report that was submitted to HHS, Health and Human Services, posted for public comment briefly in I think it was January of last year, a year ago, and then submitted and not posted. I know there was active industry lobbying against that report and against members of our group, even before we started doing the analyses and had presented any draft findings. So I think that's out there, and there's a number of news articles where industry is out there on the attack. I've heard that sort of lobbying to sort of water down the dietary guidelines with respect to alcohol was perhaps the top alcohol industry lobbying priority for the past couple of years. I don't know that, but I think, you know, for all of these things, whether it's tobacco, whether it's gambling, whether it's alcohol, I'm sure your listeners may or may not be familiar with this term, the commercial determinants of health, right? So, you know, in the last 20 years, there's been this growing recognition of social determinants of health, right? That is that your sort of quality of life and the length of your life is most closely tied to your socioeconomic status. It's not how close you live to a cancer center or whether you take a cholesterol lowering, you know, thing. But if you look worldwide, the social factors are the real drivers of health, right? So people have sort of glommed onto that in the last 20 years, and that we can't just sort of talk about health care in isolation. We need to talk about overall social health and well-being, and health care is a part of that. Well, there's another important determinant of health, and that's commercial determinants of health, and that is for products or services that are, you know, highly addictive in nature. There's lots of money to be made. There's tons of money to be made selling alcohol, tobacco, gambling products. You name it. Pornography, all these things are highly lucrative businesses, right? And of course, you know, businesses like to sell more stuff. That's their job. And so this is definitely the case with alcohol, that industry is very active. And this is expected. And on top of that, they have spent billions of dollars on advertising to portray a certain, you know, not only to market their products directly, but to portray a certain social norm or social climate around alcohol, which is one that's based on humor, one that's based on enjoyment and that sort of thing. Social lubrication, which I know we're going to get to later.
Yes,
So.
we will talk about that later. We do need to take a quick break right now. Our topic is what the latest research says about alcohol and health. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. We're learning about alcohol's impacts on health, what medical experts recommend about alcohol consumption, and what to know about alcohol and cancer. My guest is Dr. Tim Namey. He's a leading alcohol epidemiologist and a physician, and he's a professor with the University of Victoria, and he was with Boston Medical Center. We invite you to join the conversation. Have you decided to drink less? And if so, why? Are you concerned about the growing evidence that alcohol can cause cancer? Email us at talk@mainpublic.org. You can comment on Facebook or Instagram, or you can give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. 399-3566. And Dr. Namy, I'm going to read Linda's questions on Facebook. She's got a whole bunch of them. So let's see whether you can answer at least maybe a couple of these. She says, I'd love to hear how alcohol impacts the various tissues in the body, skin, gut, organs, and how that impacts our longevity or increases probability of disease. Here's some more. Is the impact on the consumption of alcohol more about how each person actually processes it, and therefore the impact depends on the human variable? And what is the impact of alcohol on brain cells? Does that affect your memory ability down the road in one's life? So lots of questions, but ones that I think a lot of people are wondering about. So I don't know if you could try to tackle those.
All right. Well, Linda's covered a few book chapters in her questions, but we'll try to go through it really quickly. We'll go kind of, so her first question, I think, was sort of like impacts different parts of the body or tissues in the body. So we can start with the top, with the brain. And I think she came back to that also. So there is one thing people are concerned about is dementia. At least I am. Being, you know, I'm still in my prime. It's a good thing this isn't a visual. No, but so the point is there's actually a form of dementia called alcoholic dementia. You know, alcohol is a sort of pickles cells, right? We can preserve things in alcohol, and alcohol is a potent neurotoxin, as evidenced by its role in fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, right? So alcohol definitely can contribute to dementia, particularly above, you know, again, very low amounts of consumption. So I think that's an important thing. And also because drinking more than a little bit of alcohol can contribute to high blood pressure, which again is a risk factor for dementia. So reducing alcohol consumption is an important part of people's dementia prevention package, or should be. You know, in terms of strokes, there are two kinds of strokes, the kind where you have bleeding into the brain and the kind where there's a blood clot that blocks flow to the brain. And again, more than a little bit of alcohol consumption is a risk factor for so-called ischemic strokes. That's the where the blood vessel gets blocked. And any amount of alcohol pretty much increases the risk of those hemorrhagic or bleeding kinds of strokes. Other things for the brain, people who drink quite a bit, well, it's a risk factor for epilepsy, not necessarily as a cause, but people, it reduces your seizure threshold. So people who have a seizure disorder, you know, again, have to be very careful with their alcohol consumption. The other thing is that people who drink a lot at a time or just are heavier drinkers may have had sort of head trauma and have some little scars. And so that can also contribute to the development of seizures later in life. And then we kind of touched on FASD, and we'll just jump down. Heart, we already touched on it. Then again, more than that, alcohol is actually an important cardiovascular risk factor above low levels for all the major forms of heart disease. Lungs, not too much going on. The whole GI system is very sensitive to the effects of alcohol, whether it's gastritis, you know, like acid, heartburn, ulcers, and then those cancers of the gastrointestinal tract, including the mouth, the voice box, the esophagus, the intestines, and the liver. Kidneys, not too much of an effect. Which one to help me out here? Then we can think about orthopedic things, right? That we get into the category of injuries and violence. So alcohol is a potent, you know, this is, again, we're talking about patterns of consumption. Is a potent risk factor for orthopedic problems, that sort of thing. And we already talked about cancer, so I think that's good. And then I think Linda also asked about differences in the way people process alcohol. So there are some differences, but I think, if anything, too much is made of them in a way. You know, a lot of people talk about the sort of how women may be more vulnerable to a certain amount of alcohol than men. That's based on the idea that, first of all, women typically weigh less. So the same number of drinks in a woman will result in a higher blood alcohol concentration than a man. Women also have slightly lower amounts of the enzyme that metabolizes alcohol. So women are at slightly increased risk on that basis. However, men account for about 3/4 of all deaths from alcohol because they drink more, and they're more likely to binge drink when they drink. And also because I was just quoted on this in the New York Times, it seemed to go over well, because to generalize, men do more stupid things when they're impaired, so they're more likely to, we don't even need to go there, but you said get their ass kicked in a bar fight, whatever. There tend to be they may be under the influence of alcohol more sort of aggressive or risk-taking. Again, this may be partly biologic and partly sort of how they're socialized. So there, I think some of these differences are a bit overrated. When we did our study, by the way, for the alcohol intake and health study, when you look for men and women, the risks of dying early due to alcohol are virtually identical for men and women up till about 10 drinks per week. And then you start to see that, yeah, above that level, the risks for women, again, at that fixed set amount of alcohol, are greater. But at lower levels, they're really the same. And that's important. And that's why I think a lot of countries have actually harmonized the recommended limits for men and women, is because actually, when you look at the studies, the risks at sort of lower levels where guidelines tend to operate are actually quite similar.
Well, you managed to cover pretty much the whole human body very well, so thank you for that. But, hearing all that, it's a little bit scary for anyone who even drinks, less than one drink a day. It seems as if the medical community is really saying, don't drink at all. If you really want to have no risk for these things, just don't drink at all. And there is a big trend, to cutting out alcohol completely. Is that something that realistically physicians do try to tell patients, or is that something where it's like it's not realistic, so don't set that as the bar?
Well, I think, listen, the I think it's, again, from the health lane, it's good that people drink very little or none at all. This idea of no risk and low risk is very difficult. Or the wording, for example, that the WHO says that there's no safe limit of alcohol consumption. To me, that even starts to sound a little bit absolutist, right? So I think we have to remember, I do think it's accurate to say that there is risk at any level of consumption. Let's just take something like an alcohol use disorder. About 1 in 4 people who begin to drink alcohol, and again, most people, you'll pretty much know by people when they're age 20 or so whether they're going to become drinkers or not. But about 1 in 4 people at some point in their life will develop an alcohol use disorder, right? Doesn't mean that they'll always have those criteria, but that's a pretty impressive percent. So, just beginning to drink alcohol, yes, there's some risk. On the other hand, for people who are sort of established drinkers who have not, who don't drink much and are drinking, a few drinks per week, I mean, the best available studies, and they're not perfect, we could discuss that later, show that there's really very little or negligible increased risk. So I think, again, the idea is to get down to a low amount. But I do think it's very important that not drinking at all is a viable option. And I mean that socially. It used to be that if you went to a party or a gathering, and you weren't drinking, at least this is the way I feel, you kind of had to explain, oh, like it was almost a presumption that you were either like a recovering, in recovery from an alcohol use disorder, or there was some medical problem you had. But I think one good thing that's happened is that a lot more people are choosing not to drink. And what's good is that I think that's becoming also socially acceptable. So while I think alcohol is a legal drug and and should be sold, I do think it's nice that it's not this. Things are perhaps becoming a little bit less, sort of alcocentric socially.
Is there an actual, are there documented trend downward? I know that I keep hearing that young people today drink less, and is that
Yeah.
something you're seeing in the numbers?
Yeah, the, Again, the last few years, per capita consumption, that is the total amount of alcohol sold in the US, has declined a little bit, not a ton, but let's say 4 or 5%. So that's actually kind of meaningful. And younger people, usually it's interesting because usually with adults and youth, their drinking is highly correlated over time and within households. That's another thing we should talk about. But the interesting thing is we have seen a bit of a divergence where, where adult drinking has stayed sort of stable, where youth drinking has declined and youth binge drinking has declined. Although it's interesting, it's been more among boys than among or young men than among young women. So now, for example, in high school, students' rates of drinking and binge drinking are similar for boys and girls, which is interesting. But yes, in general, youth are drinking less. They're doing a lot of things less, except for cannabis, but for they're having like less
That's
sex. So they're doing lots of things less, and that's a really interesting sort of whole area unto itself, whether it's, they're getting a, is it because they're so happy with social media? I don't know, they're just not doing this stuff,
well,
or maybe they're worried that, they're, I don't know, who knows, but
you've given us
they
a
are
good topic
drinking a bit
for
less.
another Maine Calling show for sure. Got to explore that angle. But Allison is calling in now from Portland, so let's go to her. Allison, hi. What's your comment or question?
Hi there. My name's Allison. I'm calling from Portland. I just wanted to say thank you guys for bringing kind of into light the importance of the long-term and harmful effects of alcohol. I think it kind of gets put to a back burner sometimes, especially with the current climate we have here in the States with opioid and other drugs, a little bit more in focus. Also, the correlation between women and young girls drinking. I think that the numbers. I'd love to see some numbers, comparing that, due to whatever it may be, trauma, inability to mask anymore, especially in older women, menopausal women. There's so many factors that play into, the women, why women, do tend to develop substance use disorder later in life, or from, an escalation from teenager to adulthood. I myself am in recovery, and I think it's so important to really just to bring this up, relatively regularly, to kind of remind people.
Sure. Well, thank you for calling, Allison. Good to hear from you. Dr. Namy.
Yeah, can you help me, Cindy, for the first part? So Allison was asking in the first part, cutting out. I wasn't having trouble hearing. What was the
Oh, okay. I mean, at the beginning part, she was thanking us for covering this because she feels like I wanted you to comment on this. She feels like, the tendency is because of other substances like opioids, getting a lot of attention that alcohol sometimes isn't talked about as much. And then she was talking about women and alcohol consumption.
Got it. Yeah.
So I did, because I know you do your work in substance use. I was curious what you have to say about the fact that a lot of people are like, well, alcohol's not as bad. So, compared
Yeah.
with some of the stuff you could do.
Right. Well, I think it's a really important, I'm not going to diminish the importance of the opioid crisis. I mean, if you just want to count numbers, the best estimates are that are upwards of 170,000 people are dying from alcohol each and every year in the US, which is, more than double that even now from opioids, or somewhere around double. And also, it's the costliest substance, I would say, alcohol and tobacco come close. Tobacco, if you again, kills the most people, but alcohol, because it tends a lot of the alcohol-related conditions can occur among younger people, particularly trauma, like the association with suicide and homicide and injuries and violence. In terms of total years of life lost, alcohol, approaches that of tobacco. In terms of economic costs, alcohol is probably the highest because we have a lot of costs related to things like insurance, healthcare costs, like very costly conditions like cancer or liver cirrhosis. And we also have the cost to the criminal and legal justice system, things of that nature. And because a lot of alcohol's effects are also secondhand effects, more than any other drug, a lot of the reason why tobacco control policies went into effect, in the decades past is because, 5% of deaths from smoking are from secondhand smoke. Well, think about alcohol with all the effects of, especially, sort of domestic violence, and child abuse and neglect, these sort of things. A lot of the, sexually transmitted infections, harms to fetuses, a lot of the effects of alcohol are secondhand effects. So I think it's, I guess I'm doing a good job promoting the importance of alcohol. But, because most adults in the US drink and because it's so culturally entrenched, particularly in people of white European ancestry, it kind of gets a pass. And sort of disappears and looks like wallpaper. So that's not at all to diminish the importance of the opioid crisis, but I'm glad that that Allison makes that point. And I think because many of us have, or most of us have grown up in environments where alcohol consumption is normalized and in fact celebrated, and we all grew up joking about getting drunk or doing crazy things. It's good to take that into consideration when we kind of think about it in the health lens. And then, talking about alcohol and women, it's a really great topic, and I'm glad that Allison raised it. I think it's hard to cover it all, but if you look at a lot of the marketing, is geared towards older women, and we saw a lot in the pandemic about sort of the, mommy juice and it's wine o'clock, and selling this notion that, women are, yes, they're, hardworking, but the idea is that the only way that they can relax and be rewarded is to drink, particularly white wine at the end of the day or during the day, whenever. So I think, and then there are lots of other structural reasons too. She mentioned trauma. That is an important contributor for an important fraction of people who drink excessively. So those are all great points.
Okay, and great answers. Thank you for that. We do need to take another break. Our phone number is 800-399-3566. What questions do you have about alcohol and health? This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. I am talking with physician and alcohol epidemiologist Dr. Tim Namey to find out what the latest research says about alcohol consumption and what it means for health. Dr. Namey is with the University of Victoria. Share your comments and questions. Email us at talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram, or you can call 1-800-399-3566. We have a lot of questions coming in, Dr. Namey, but something you said earlier, I wanted to loop back with quickly about how science and research can change, the evidence can change. And you've mentioned how we thought for years and years and years, you hear drinking red wine is good for your heart. And everybody was happy with that kind of data. And then the thinking changed, and it's because new research came out. So two things I want you just to explain, why that flipped, and then also why people need to kind of understand and accept that science changes.
Well, I think science is itself part of a hallmark of science is its dynamism and people. We try to learn new knowledge, but that knowledge, in so doing, right? If we learn new stuff, that means that it wasn't there before. So we have to recognize that things change. I think the, without getting into gory details, I think that the idea of the health halo for moderate drinking has that halo has kind of fallen off over the past couple of decades, and there's lots of reasons for it. We won't get too far into it, but the main one I think is that people who get enrolled in a study in middle life who are drinking very moderate amounts of alcohol tend to be socially advantaged. Maybe have nice jobs. They go to the get lots of exercise. Their children smile at them. All these kinds of things. And those people are the ones who tend to, like, if they drink, tend to have, been able to go most of their life drinking moderately, not, drinking too much, not dying of an alcohol problem. Then you end up with these people who I described who, so the point is that drinking moderately is a reflection of a generally healthy life. and not its cause is basically the idea. So that's changed.
Okay, so flipping the cause and effect there. All right, let's
Yeah.
go to an email from Mary Lou. Do the effects of alcohol on the brain and body lessen or repair once sober?
Well, in general, the answer is yes, things can bounce back, particularly like we know that people's livers can bounce back to a certain, they can take a joke for a while. The risk of cancer can, there's very limited evidence on alcohol-related cancers, but it appears like that maybe after 15 years or so that the risk of certain cancers will return to what it is normally. With the brain, of course, like think about it, when we get acutely impaired or intoxicated, right, after hours or so that will disappear. So for the brain, it depends on the type of the damage that's been done. But in general, yes, there can be some good recovery for most organ systems.
Okay, let's go now to Meredith calling from Brewer. Hi, Meredith, go ahead.
Hi. I want to go back to the comment about young people drinking less. By Maine public standards, I'm young. I'm 22. And I think that it's not a simple answer, but a lot of it is in our economy. So the cost of drinking being out of reach for young people, like with all food, has inflated in prices. So if we need to buy food or we need to buy beer, we got to buy food, right? And the price of beer and liquor has inflated alongside our food. But also with the rise of remote work, but also the rise of unemployment after college with people my age, we don't have the infrastructure to socially drink like we did before, right? Going to get beers after work. I just did hand quotations, but you can't see it. Can't really exist if everyone's working from home.
Such great points, Meredith. And I just want to ask you a question real quick. Is there also a factor that like the coolness or the coolness factor of wanting to be healthy and well, like that's more acceptable or a goal for younger people?
I think it's less about wellness because very little of what comes from social media is actually about us being better and more about us fitting into what social media has fed us as better. But gym bros can't hit their macros if they're drinking beer because it's high in carbs, and carbs are not very trendy right now.
All right, great points, Meredith. Let's hear from Dr. Naimi about that.
Yeah, all great points. I'm not going to add too much to the point. In terms of the economics, the price and economic factors are key drivers of alcohol consumption. That's why public health people like me enjoy raising taxes. And we would much rather that alcohol be taxed and property taxes and income taxes be lowered. But the point is that the price of alcohol matters a lot. And in economic terms, alcohol is actually a luxury good, which means that on average, people drink more when the economy is better. I think a lot of people kind of get confused because they think, oh, people that are poor tend to drink more. And that's actually not true. There are people who drink a lot who become poor because of their drinking. But in general, Meredith's got a point that people, affordability affects alcohol. And we like policies that actually raise the price of alcohol relative to other goods and services in the economy so that they shift, to things that are arguably more, healthy and productive. In terms of remote work, yeah, that's an interesting point about going out with people. And I mean that she makes the flip side of that is I think during the pandemic, people were sitting home and they kind of start staring at their wine bottle earlier in the day. But that's a great point. And then the carbs and calories. Yeah, alcohol has 7 calories per gram, which is almost as much as fat, which is 9 calories per gram, and then also has a lot of carbs. So just the ethanol component is 7, whereas carbs and protein are 4 calories per gram. So alcohol is quite calorie dense.
Well, thank you for your call, Meredith. And Dr. Naimi, earlier we were talking about those, again, those new federal guidelines. And when those were issued, Dr. Mehmet Oz, very well known and is now in working for the federal government, he made the point when there was some question of saying, okay, so just consume less alcohol. He sort of defended alcohol and said it's a social lubricant. And his implication was it creates benefits in terms of social connections and bonding and having fun with your friends. And a lot of people believe that's the sure. flip side. It's good for your health in that way. So can you comment on that?
Well, I think that's a totally legit point, right? I'm talking to you from a perspective of a public health person, and I think it's important to, you know, meet people with where they're at. And I always say that there are many reasons that people, besides health, there are many reasons why people choose to drink alcohol or choose not to drink alcohol. And certainly one of the motivations that people listen, you know, 70% of the population wouldn't drink alcohol if there was, you know, wasn't something in it for them, right? So I think social lubrication is, for some people, a reason why they drink. Perhaps they've been sort of grown up with, you know, they haven't kind of learned, if it sounds too harsh, but it is an important, can be a social lubricant, it can be a social crutch, depending on how one looks at it. But I think, again, even there, the message about drinking less resonates. In other words, are you more social at one or two drinks or six or seven drinks? I think the point is that when you drink more, you know, then the antisocial stuff starts to occur. So, again, even for people who use it as a social lubricant, I think the message about drinking less or drinking perhaps more mindfully, you know, for special occasions or for when you're socializing, is something good to think about.
We did get a couple comments on Facebook kind of related to that. Barry says, I drink less and less, rarely now. The idea of routinely ingesting a known neurotoxin as a social lubricant is rapidly losing popularity. Inebriated people have little awareness of how obnoxious they sound. And Kyla on Facebook, I had to stop because I started feeling the yuck without feeling the yaw. So there you go. A question here about the size of servings. When we talk about those limits in one drink, what is that based on? And is it based on, you know, whether it's hard alcohol, beer and wine?
Oh, that's a great question. A standard drink in the US is defined on the amount of ethanol. Ethanol is the active, that's what we mean by alcohol. That's the active ingredient in alcohol. And 14 grams of ethanol is a standard drink. And the nice thing is that there is about that amount of alcohol in a can of beer, of 5% alcohol by volume beer. Same amount of ethanol in that as there is in a 5-ounce glass of 12% wine. And that's the same as the amount of ethanol in a 40% ABV liquor, you know, like rum or vodka. So like a shot of liquor and a glass of wine and a can of beer all have a standard drink, are all one standard drink, and it's based on the ethanol content.
Okay, I'll try to squeeze in a couple more quick questions. Email from James. Is there a difference based on ethnicity in terms of the effects that alcohol might have on you?
Well, I would say the main differences are one, social vulnerability. So there's something called the harms paradox, which means that people who are more socially vulnerable, lower income, worse insurance, are at higher risk of death or problems at any level of alcohol consumption. So to the extent that ethnicity tracks with income or socioeconomic status, then yes.
But not physically.
But not physically. Again, there are some, there's a gene that's more common in Asian populations that changes the way alcohol is metabolized that leads people to generally drink less for those people who have the copy or the double copy of the gene. But I think for the main point I would say is that in general, the effects are pretty similar.
Okay, we only have time for one last question. I don't know if this one's okay to ask you, but an email from Carol, does Dr. Namy ever drink? And if so, how much?
Well, that's a great question. You know, the funny thing is I always get this question and usually I don't answer it because I always, when it's a health reporter, I'll say, well, when you interview a cardiologist, do you ask if they've had a heart attack? I mean, why do you, because I always feel like whatever answer I give will, will sort of like bias what I said. If I say I don't drink, then they'll think, oh, he's a teetotaler and is a, you know. But I, because this is Maine Public Radio, I actually, you know, did grow up drinking. I still do drink some alcohol, but not that much, I would say. So maybe I drink a few drinks a week. I think I'm more mindful about when I drink. And yeah, so that's I have my stories to tell from my younger days, but
Oh, we have to have you back then.
Well,
Well,
it's sort of fun because my mom is, you know, sort of a Yankee coming from a sort of heavy drinking, and then my dad was didn't drink. So, but that's my story.
I appreciate that you did answer that question and definitely appreciate having you joining us today. So, Dr. Tim Maney is our guest. He's a physician, alcohol epidemiologist, professor of medical sciences at the University of Victoria. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue. And tomorrow on the show, our birding experts join us to talk about what to look for this time of year and about the newly completed Maine Bird Atlas. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.